A reading from The Amber Spyglass by Philip Pullman, chapter 16, middle of the chapter. A cold wind was blowing, snapping at their eyelids, and the dark blue hawk soared up in a mighty draught, wheeling and screaming in the wild air. King Ogunwe drew his coat round him and rested his hand on his cheetah Damon's head. Mrs. Coulter said humbly to the angel, "Excuse me, my lady, your name is Zephania." "Yes," said the angel. Her appearance impressed Mrs. Coulter just as her fellows had impressed the witch Ruta Scandi when she found them in the sky.
Ruta Scazia.
Scadi. When she found them in the sky. She was not shining, but shone on. Though there was no source of light, she was tall, naked, winged, and her lined face was older than any living creature Mrs. Coulter had ever seen. "Are you one of the angels who rebelled so long ago?" "Yes, and since then I have been watching, wandering, between many worlds. Now I have pledged my allegiance to Lord Asriel, because I see, in his great enterprise, the best hope of destroying the tyranny at last. But if you fail, then we shall all be destroyed and cruelty will reign forever." As they spoke, they followed Lord Asriel's rapid strides along the wind-beaten battlements towards a mighty staircase going down so deep that even the flaring lights on sconces down the walls could not disclose the bottom. Past them swooped the blue hawk, gliding down and down into the gloom, with each flaring light making his feathers flicker as he passed it, until he was merely a tiny spark, and then nothing. The angel had moved on to Lord Asriel's side, and Mrs. Coulter found herself descending next to the African king. "Excuse my ignorance, sir," she said, "but I had never seen or heard of a being like the man on the blue hawk until the fight in the cave yesterday. Where does he come from? Can you tell me about his people? I wouldn't offend him for the world, but if I speak without knowing something about him, I might be unintentionally rude." "You do well to ask," said King Ogunwe. "His people are proud. Their world developed unlike ours. There are two kinds of conscious being there, humans and Gallivespians. The humans are mostly servants of the authority, and they have been trying to exterminate the small people since the earliest time anyone can remember. They regard them as diabolic. Soon the Gallivespians still cannot quite trust those who are our size, but they are fierce and proud warriors and deadly enemies and valuable spies. Are all his people with you, or are they divided as humans are? There are some who are with the enemy, but most are with us. And the angels? You know, I thought until recently that angels were an invention of the Middle Age. They were just imaginary. To find yourself speaking to one is disconcerting, isn't it? How many are with Lord Asriel?" "Mrs. Coulter," said the king, "these questions are just the sort of things a spy would want to find out." "A fine sort of spy I'd be to ask you so transparently," she replied. "I'm a captive, sir. I couldn't get away, even if I had a safe place to flee to. From now on, I'm harmless. You can take my word for that." "If you say so, I'm very happy to believe you," said the king. "Angels are more difficult to understand than any human being. They are not all of one kind. To begin with, some have greater powers than others, and there are complicated alliances among them and ancient enmities that we know little about. The authority has been suppressing them since he came into being." She stopped. She was genuinely shocked. The African king halted beside her, thinking she was unwell, and indeed the light of the flaring sconce above her did throw ghastly shadows over her face. "You say that so casually," she said, "as if it were something I should know too. But how can it be? The authority created the worlds, didn't he? He existed before everything. How can he have come into being?" "This is angelic knowledge," said Ogunwe. "It shocked some of us, too, to learn that the authority is not the creator. There may have been a creator, or there may not. We don't know. All we know is that at some point the authority took charge, and since then the angels have rebelled and human beings have struggled against him too. This is the last rebellion. Never before have humans and angels and beings from all the worlds made a common cause. This is the greatest force ever assembled, but it may still not be enough. We shall see. What does Lord Asriel intend? What is this world, and why has he come here? He led us here because this world is empty. Empty of conscious life, that is. We are not colonialists, Mrs. Coulter. We haven't come to conquer, but to build. And is he going to attack the kingdom of heaven? Agonwe looked at her levelly. We're not going to invade the kingdom, he said. But if the kingdom invades us, they had better be ready for war, because we are prepared. Mrs. Coulter, I am a king, but it's my proudest task to join King Asriel in setting up a world where there are no kingdoms at all, no kings, no bishops, no priests. The kingdom of heaven has been known by that name since the authority first set himself above the rest of the angels. We want no part of it. This world is different. We intend to be free citizens of the Republic of Heaven. Mrs. Coulter wanted to say more, to ask the dozen questions that rose in her lips, but the king had moved on, unwilling to keep his commander waiting, and she had to follow. The staircase led so far down that by the time it reached a level floor, the sky behind them in the head of the flight was quite invisible. Well before halfway, she had little breath left, but she made no complaint and moved on down until it opened out into a massive hall lit by glowing crystals in the pillars that supported the roof. Ladders, gantries, beams and walkways crossed the gloom above, with small figures moving about them purposefully. Lord Asriel was speaking to his commanders when Mrs. Coulter arrived, and without waiting to let her rest, he moved on across the great hall, where occasionally a bright figure would sweep through the air or alight on the floor for a brief, snatched word with him. The air was dense and warm. Mrs. Coulter noticed that, presumably as a courtesy to Lord Rocket, every pillar had an empty bracket at human head height, so that his hawk could perch there and allow the Galavespians to be included in the discussion. But they did not stay in the great hall for long. At the far side, an attendant hauled open a heavy double door to let them through onto the platform of a railway. There waiting was a small closed carriage drawn by an Anbaric locomotive. The engineer bowed and his brown monkey daemon retreated behind his legs at the sight of the golden monkey. Lord Asriel spoke to the man briefly and showed the others into the carriage, which, like the hall, was lit by those glowing crystals held on silver brackets against the mirrored mahogany panels. As soon as Lord Asriel had joined them, the train began to move, gliding smoothly away from the platform and into a tunnel, accelerating briskly. Only the sound of the wheels on the smooth track gave any idea of their speed. "Where are we going?" Mrs. Coulter asked. "To the armory," Lord Asriel said shortly, and turned away to talk quietly with the angel. Mrs. Coulter said to Lord Rocker, "My lord, are your spies always sent out in pairs? Why do you ask?" "Simple curiosity. My daemon and I found ourselves at the stalemate when we met them recently in that cave. And I was intrigued to see how well they fought." "Why intrigued? Did you not expect people of our size to be good fighters?" She looked at him coolly, aware of the ferocity of his pride. "No," she said, "I thought we would beat you easily, and you very nearly beat us. I'm happy to admit my mistake. But do you always fight in pairs? You are a pair, are you not, you and your daemon? Did you expect us to concede the advantage?" he said, and his haughty stare, brilliantly clear even in the soft light of the crystals, dared her to ask more. She sat down modestly and said nothing. Several minutes went past, and Mrs. Coulter felt the train taking them downwards, even deeper into the mountain's heart. She couldn't guess how far they went, but when at least 15 minutes had gone by, the train began to slow, and presently they drew up to a platform where the Anbaric lights seemed brilliant after the darkness of the tunnel. Lord Asriel opened the doors and they got out into an atmosphere so hot and sulphur laden that Mrs. Coulter had to gasp. The air rang with the pounding of mighty hammers and the clangorous screech of iron on stone. An attendant hauled open the doors leading off the platform, and instantly the noise redoubled and the heat swept over them like a breaking wave. A blaze of scorching light made them shade their eyes. Only Zephania seemed unaffected by the onslaught of sound and light and heat. When her senses had adjusted, Mrs. Coulter looked around, alive with curiosity. She had seen forges, ironworks, manufactories. In her own world, the biggest seemed like a village smithy besides this. Hammers the size of houses were lifted in a moment to the distant ceiling and then hurled downwards to flatten balks of iron the size of tree trunks, pounding them flat in a fraction of a second with a blow that made the very mountain tremble. From a vent in the rocky wall, a river of sulphurous molten metal flowed until it was cut off by an adamant gate, and the brilliant seething flood rushed through channels and sluices and over weirs into row upon row of moulds to settle and cool in a cloud of evil smoke. Gigantic slicing machines and rollers cut and folded and pressed sheets of inch-thick iron as if it were paper tissue paper, and then those monstrous hammers pounded it flat again, layering metal upon metal with such force that the different layers became one tougher one over and over again. If Yorick Berenson could have seen this armoury, he might have admitted that these people knew something about working with metal. Mrs. Coulter could only look and wonder. It was impossible to speak and be understood, and no one tried. And now Lord Asriel was gesturing to the small group to follow him along a grated walkway suspended over an even larger vault below, where miners toiled with picks and spades to hack the bright metals from the mother rock. They passed over the walkway and down a long, rocky corridor where stalactites hung gleaming with strange colours and where the pounding and grinding and hammering gradually faded. Mrs. Coulter could feel a cool breeze on her heated face. The crystals that gave them light were neither mounted on sconces nor enclosed in glowing pillars, but scattered loosely on the floor, and there were no flaring torches to add to the heat. So little by little, the party began to feel cold again, and presently they came out quite suddenly into the night air. They were at a place where part of the mountain had been hacked away, making a space as wide and open as a parade ground. Further along they could see, dimly lit, great iron doors in the mountainside, some open and some shut, and from out of one of the mighty doorways men were hauling something draped in a tarpaulin. "What is that?" Mrs. Coulter said to the African king, and he replied, "The intention craft." Mrs. Coulter had no idea what that could mean and watched with intense curiosity as they prepared to take off the tarpaulin. She stood close to King Agunwe as if for shelter and said, "How does it work? What does it do?" "We're about to see," said the king. It looked like some kind of complex drilling apparatus, or the cockpit of a gyrocopter, or the cabin of a massive crane. It had a glass canopy over a seat with at least a dozen levers and handles banked in front of it. It stood on six legs, each jointed and sprung at a different angle to the body, so that it seemed both energetic and ungainly. And the body itself was a mass of pipework, cylinders, pistons, coiled cables, switchgear and valves and gauges. It was hard to tell what was structure and what was not, because it was only lit from behind and most of it was hidden in gloom. Lord Rocky and his hawk had glided up to it directly, circling above, examining it from all sides. Lord Asriel and the angel were close in discussion with the engineers, and men were clambering down from the craft itself, one carrying a clipboard, another a length of cable. Mrs. Coulter's eyes gazed at the craft hungrily, memorising every part of it, making sense of its complexity, and as she watched, Lord Asriel swung himself up into the seat, fastening a leather harness round his waist and shoulders and setting a helmet securely on his head. His daemon, the snow leopard, sprang up to follow him, and he turned to adjust something beside her. The engineer called up, Lord Ezra replied, and the men withdrew to the doorway. The intention craft moved, though Mrs. Coulter was not sure how. It was almost as if it had quivered, though there it was, quite still, poised with a strange energy on those six insect legs. As she looked, it moved again, and then she saw what was happening. Various parts of it were revolving, turning this way and that, scanning the dark sky overhead. Lord Asriel sat busily moving this lever, checking that dial, adjusting that control, and then suddenly the intention craft vanished. Somehow it had sprung into the air. It was hovering above them now, as high as a treetop, turning slowly to the left. There was no sound of an engine, no hint of how it was held against gravity. It simply hung in the air. "Listen," said King of Gunway, "to the south." She turned her head and strained to hear. There was a wind that moaned around the edge of the mountain, and there were the heavy hammer blows from the presses which she felt through the soles of her feet. And there was the sound of voices from the lighted doorway. But at some signal, the voices stopped and the lights were extinguished. In the quiet, Mrs. Coulter could hear, very faintly, the chop, chop, chop of gyrocopter engines on the gust of wind. "Who are they?" she said quietly. "Decoys," said the king. "My pilots flying a mission to tempt the enemy to follow. Watch." She widened her eyes, trying to see anything against the heavy dark with its few stars. Above them, the intention craft hung as firmly as if it were anchored and bolted there. No gust of wind had the slightest effect on it. No light came from the cockpit, so it was very difficult to see, and the figure of Lord Asriel was out of sight completely. Then she saw the first sight of a group of lights low in the sky at the same moment as the engine sound became loud enough to hear steadily. Six gyrocopters flying fast, one of them seemingly in trouble, for smoke trailed from it and it flew lower than the others. They were making for the mountains, but on a course to take them past it and beyond. And behind them, in close pursuit, came a motley collection of flyers. It was not easy to make out what they were, but Mrs. Coulter saw a heavy gyrocopter of a strange kind, two straight-winged aircraft, one great bird that glided with effortless speed, carrying two armed riders and three or four angels. "A raiding party, said King of Gunway. They were closing on the gyrocopters. Then a line of light blazed from one of the straight-winged aircraft, followed a second or two later by the sound, a deep crack. But the shell never reached its target. The crippled gyrocopter, because in the same instant as they saw the light and before they heard the crack, the watchers on the mountain saw a flash from the intention craft and a shell exploded in midair. Mrs. Coulter had hardly time to understand that almost instantaneous sequence of light and sound before the battle was underway. Nor was it all easy to follow, because the sky was so dark and the movement of every flyer so quick. But a series of nearly silent flashes lit the mountainside, accompanied by short hisses like the escape of steam. Each flash struck somehow at a different radar. The aircraft caught fire or exploded. The giant bird uttered a scream like the tearing of a mountain high curtain and plummeted onto the rocks far below.
How much page is left in the chapter?
I think this must be the longest chapter in the book. Two. Oh my goodness. Three. Four. Five. Six. Seven. Oh, eight. Oh, God. Is this chapter 17? Yeah. Oh, too much. Tap me when you want me to stop, okay?
I'm tired.
Okay, will we stop there for the moment? Okay, darling, we stop there. We can come back to it another night. It sounds like another battle is going on, but it'll go on for a long time.
What time is it?
It's 9 o'clock.